Welcome to Woman Today, a magazine program designed to encourage and equip women today for a better tomorrow together. Hi there, I am Larice Faree and I serve as a presenter at Good News Community Radio in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. I believe that we do life and faith better together, so today I'm excited to introduce Athana Schultz, author of Peace in Grief, a brutally honest account of the surreal world of sudden death and her family's continued belief in God's bigger plan.
So the book is basically a very honest story about the impacts of grief on our family and just the miracle of peace that transcends understanding, you know, when you trust everything to God. So although it was quite a hectic walk, there was this weird bubble of peace in the process. So that's how the name of the book came along. It basically, the beginning tells the story. So Desmond died of COVID-19 in July 2021. And the whole book is intended to be honest on behalf of everybody who can't tell their story and who feel that they're not sure what they're going through is normal. And especially from a Christian context, you know, a lot of people think that they should handle it a certain way because there's an expectation on Christians. So I'm being very vulnerable. I think it's what God called me to do. And then there's a bit of a guide on how to handle grief and also for other people who want to assist people in grief. So there's like three chapters and how to prepare for it. You know, we're all eventually going to go through grief. So that process. And then I've got right at the back a list of scriptures that just address different aspects of the grieving process, yeah, and going through life and hardship. And although the book is Christian, it will be useful to anybody. It's not judgmental towards non-believers in any way. And there's a lot of just really practical stuff that's not something you need to be a Christian for to be able to benefit from it.
Athana, you know, it was such a tragedy during COVID. Many people lost spouses or children or parents. And I think it will just give the listeners a better sense of your loss if we dive into the story, you know, of how maybe you met Desmond and just how the connection was formed between the two of you and, you know, how it carried on into your marriage. So who was Desmond and how did your story come together?
So the last bit of my book is actually a bit of a part of the eulogy I gave at his celebration service. So Desmond and I met at church. He was 10 years older than I am. I got saved when I was 8 years old, and I had a very much an expectation of what my husband needs to be one day. And I made a list, and the stuff that was on it was he had to be the priest in my house, and he would have to handle the fact that I have a strong personality and, you know, things like that, and wanted to have kids and all kinds of stuff like that. I am a journalist, and he was a freelance photographer. That's not how we connected. Mm-hmm. It was actually a hobby that turned into a full-time job when we moved to the Garden Route. It's a couple after we got married, and we operated a business together. He was very solid person, you know, and very well loved, one of those kind of people who would listen without interrupting, and then afterwards, you know, kind of with something profound. He had a lot of people really loved him because he would just really listen, you know. Because Desmond and I were in the media, and particularly locally, his death was well published, and people knew who he was. And he was also in administration at the Nelson Mandela University George campus, so a lot of students knew him. And because it was COVID, you know, we, like a lot of people didn't even know. And only now, as I start telling my story, do people actually hear that he died, which is just, quite bizarre. But as a couple, we've, worked together for a long time. When our kids were little, they would often go with us on media stuff. So we had a very blessed time on the corner of being exposed to life and nature. And yeah, we were a very good team. So as a couple, there were no boy jobs and girl jobs, you know. Like I used to say, he was the kind of dad that the only thing he didn't do was breastfeed. Everything else he was willing to do. He was involved as a dad, and he was very involved with my kids. So the actual loss was quite significant because we were such an interactive couple and a close family.
So how old were you when you first met Desmond?
Right. Okay. So I was what you call a young widow. I was 47 when I was 57. And then my children, Emma was 17 and in matric when Des died, and Nathan was 14 and in grade 8 at the time.
So what was the impact on your children of losing their father?
Obviously, it was significant in the sense that he was very involved in their lives. And they are, I think, a lot that you only find out as you go along. Emma had to finish matric, so we like literally took a day at a time with her. Nathan didn't have to go back full time immediately school wise, so I could manage some of it. I speak about some of it in the book, but there are stuff around their lives that I've, for their own privacy, haven't really put in the book, just because, you know, the processes around it, they have to, you know, go on with life. I'm quite happy to expose a lot about me. But these were different. And yeah, I think the big thing was just that in the beginning you're quite a zombie to some degree. But I was very determined to never stop talking about him, to talk about him in a natural way. So the kids always felt like they could speak to me about Des or the loss, or, you know, we would do something and I would say, oh, Papa would have really liked that. And now my son would say that, or he would say, oh, he's, you know, keeping some tradition or something that Papa did. So right from the, I wanted them to understand that as Christians, we believe Des is in heaven and that it's a spiritual journey as much as a physical journey. And I think that helped a lot to understand, you know, that as Christians, we can deal with it with God's help. And we really tapped into the support systems at church, for instance, and youth and things like that, as much as COVID allowed, just to remain connected and to let them stay in a positive vibe, you know, when it's allowed for it.
Athana, I think when it comes to grief and when it comes to observing the grief from the outside, if you're not directly involved, like a friend or, you know, a distant family member, we can tend to want to shy away from speaking about the person who has passed away because you don't want to bring up negative emotions. You don't want to put people through that trauma again. But what I'm hearing from you is actually that it seems as if speaking about Desmond and being vocal about your experience didn't put you through the trauma again, but it seemed to help you through the trauma. Is that true? And how would you explain the right approach to outsiders speaking into this grieving period?
Yeah, so I actually have an entire chapter on what not to say to people when they're grieving. You know, I realized quite soon that I was dealing with grief differently than a lot of other people, and I believe very strongly right from the beginning that everything is according to God's plan. I find that not all of us are handling it in the same way. I think for me in particular, the way in which this happened to me was part of God's plan and purpose for me, so that I could speak on behalf of people who have a difficult time to talk about it. My whole approach is that we are still here. You know, we were left behind, but if we were meant to have gone with our loved ones, we would have. But we're still here, and that means that we still have our own plans and our own purpose here on Earth. And with that in mind, I would definitely say allow for the grieving to introduce this topic. Don't promise them things you can't deliver. Rather, just say, I'm sorry for your loss, and see where they go from there, than promising things that you can't deliver. So people don't know what to say, so they tend to say, please phone me anytime if you need help. But in reality, unless your phone is really on at 3 o'clock in the morning when this person's geezer breaks, you won't be there, and that would just, you know, worsen the situation or damp the spirits. And the other thing is to just ask him, you know, would you like to speak about it, or do you mind that I ask you questions about them? You know, just be straightforward. Don't go around it. And then afterwards, if you start seeing them a lot or whatever, to just, you know, catch up and say, you know, how are you doing? They must now already know. Some people will introduce it quickly. If you are a grieving person and you don't mind telling people about them, then introduce your loved one first, so people know, oh, okay, it's okay to talk about it, and they can ask, you know. So there's responsibility on both sides, I think.
That's quite interesting to keep in consideration, that people grieve differently, and that you should sort of take your cues from the person who is grieving. That's a very good way to think about it, that you just highlighted, that basically if they introduce the topic, that's a green light for you to engage with them in that topic. But if they don't, sort of don't try to be the first person to bring it up. And I love what you mentioned about promising things that you can keep, or just opting for not making any promises at all. Because I think when you're in that grieving period, it's such a sensitive time that people can sort of give you false hope through these promises, and that can even lead to more devastation in the light of what you're already going through. So, Athana, can you explain to us, how did Desmond's sickness and death occur? Was it a longer period that you were sort of able to prepare for it? How did it happen?
Yeah, so we all, our whole family got COVID one after the other, and it was the Delta version. So around us, there were people in our own age group starting to die, and younger people. And initially, Des was the healthiest between me and him. I was the one that lay next to the toilet and crawled around and was really affected by it. And he actually did quite all right. And only about around day 10 did he say that he's breathing isn't great. And I said to him, you know, you don't want to go to a hospital. And he said, no, he's fine. He'll let me know if he wanted to. And then sort of overnight, it got worse. And the morning of the 2nd of July, he said, no, he thinks he must go. And, you know, it was very weird at the hospital, because it was still was normal hospital hours, but you also enter from a different section in any case for COVID. And everything was through the window, and I couldn't go in. And it was also the last time I saw him, but neither him nor I really thought that he was that sick. I mean, he was, but we just didn't know it. And I was still sick as well. So I dropped him off, sorted out the medical stuff, and then waited in the car for a bit, because we weren't sure if he was actually even going to be admitted to hospital. And then eventually I drove home, because I realized it might take a while. And he then just said, no, he's been admitted, and they say he's got pneumonia, and he was quite surprised. And they said that it would be, you know, 5 days to 2 weeks that he'd be in hospital, depending on how he responds to physio. And in his ward, he was the healthiest, but it was in that time where people were coming in every day, lots and lots of people. So they would keep on adding extra beds and moving them and so on. And because he was the healthiest, he was the one that kept on moving. He was on the oxygen mask, but otherwise fine. He was doing physio and doing all right. And then 2 days later, he had a really bad setback and infection that was just becoming worse, and he wasn't responding to antibiotics. The nurse found me because there weren't any ventilators available, and they just said to him, look, he's very sick, but he responds to people speaking to him, so they're going to see if they can let me come in so that I can sit with him. And maybe if he sees me, he'll calm down a bit, because it's because he's not getting oxygen and keeps on ripping off his mask. And so I had the opportunity. It's very surreal because obviously they don't allow for people during the pandemic. So there's nowhere to sit or anything. It's very strange. I speak quite a bit in my book about the, you know, the visual stuff surrounding that. Mm-hmm. And then eventually a ventilator did become available, and he went off to ICU, and then he was in ICU for 2 weeks. Once they put the ventilator on, the doctor phoned me and he sounded very surprised. He said, yes, his stats responded immediately, normalized, he's doing surprisingly well. And the moment they put you on the ventilator, they also put you on sedation so that you don't drip the stuff out. But then what they do, they try to get them off the ventilators as soon as possible after that. So they said, no, they're going to keep him on 48 hours, but he's doing very well, and they're going to start, you know, lifting the sedation and see what they can do to see if he will breathe on his own. The first week, everybody sounded quite happy with what was happening. And then from the second week, I could hear it was unchanged. And every time they lifted sedation, he would panic. Desmond was always slightly claustrophobic, so I think that affected the situation quite a bit. And then towards the end of the second week, so he was in ICU for 14 days, they phoned me and said his organs are starting to fail. And to this day, I just believe it's God, because nobody was being allowed into the ICU at the time. But they phoned and they said, look, you know, it's probably going to be about an hour. If you willing to suit up in full PPE, you can come sit with him for the last bit. And of course you think, oh, I don't know, can I handle this? But you know you will regret it if you don't. And a friend took me, and she was not allowed to go in, but she sat and waited for me and prayed for me outside. And I went and sat with him, and I just prayed for the Holy Spirit to just be with us. And then I just sat next to him and allowed for our memories of our life together. I wanted to stay in the moment, you know, so I just kept on thinking about all the blessings with us as a couple and so on. And then at some stage, the doctor came in and said, I know it's, you know, he's gone. And I have more or less an idea of when he went. And I knew that, I'm sure he knew at the end, as his spirit left his body, that I was there. Yeah, and that was it. And then I had a good cry, and I went outside and my friends prayed for me, and we just, you know, spent some time together. And then I had to go and tell my kids, which was the toughest thing I've ever done in my whole life. And from there on, you're in a moment by moment setup in the beginning, just to get through what you need to get through. But I'm glad I wrote it down eventually in a book form, because I believe a lot of people go through that thing, and I hope it can bless people and make them realize, you know, they're not alone, and lots of us have gone through this.
So, Ifana, how close were you and Desmond during this time? You know, as a couple, what can sometimes happen with children, they can take the center stage and the marriage relationship can take a back seat. So what was the nature of your relationship to Desmond during this time?
You know, we had our 20th wedding anniversary about 2 months before we got sick. And you're 100% right. I think we realized that as our kids are starting to move out of the house, we have to refocus. We've always had a very stable relationship, but you do go through phases where things go by the wayside. And it was so miraculous. I believe all of this was God in advance. In that period just before, we sat down and we spoke about all those little nitty-gritty things that annoy us and that we get into. And we were were literally no secrets. We just spoke and spoke and spoke, and say a little bit about that in the book as well. You know, even like something very simple of money that I had put aside to tithe that I hadn't initially told them about, which is really silly because tithing hasn't got anything to do about the actual money. But, you know, yeah. But like even then, you know, I stuff like that we spoke about. And I really believe that was God preparing me, certainly. So there was an absolute miracle that we were in possibly the best place we were in our marriage in a long time, because we literally just talked about stuff, and we didn't have really big stuff, but you allow for little things to become big. Yeah, so we ended up being actually at a wonderful place at the time. But as you say, life does seem to, especially with children, you know, you tend to focus so much on the kids that you don't land up spending enough time considering your loved one the way you meant to. But yeah, so through very much a miracle, we were actually in a really, really good space when he got sick.
So Athana, did you sort of feel like life was just falling apart when it happened? You already mentioned the difficulty of having to witness it for yourself and being brave in that and taking that opportunity, and then also having to go to your children and now break the news to them. Did it seem like life was just falling apart in that season?
You know, I think for many people it does. I think that is where God's peace became a really big deal for me. It's so strange, you're using very specific words. You know, we would often discuss what God was talking to us about in our quiet time. He had a group of friends that connected, and God had said to him that things are not falling apart. They are actually coming together. And it was really about 3 or 4 weeks before we all got sick, you know. And I was only reminded about that when I started writing Desmond's eulogy. So perhaps not at the time. There's a wonderful peace and grace, and your body does protect you in your phase of shock. And certainly to some degree, there is a defense system, an autopilot kind of thing that happens in the beginning. I didn't feel completely lost, but it also had a lot to do with, I was in a really good place with my relationship with God. That in itself is a story that has a 2-year journey before. I just really recommitted my life and was spending more time in the Word. So I was spiritually in a place where not everybody is when that happens. So initially I didn't feel like everything was falling apart. And to this day, I believe in God's plan and that everything will be used according to His will. Romans 8 in particular, the bigger picture of Romans 8, and not just the verse that says, you know, things will work out for the good, everything. Those to love, and then I always have that according to His purpose. And so it was more a thing of moments of being overwhelmed than a complete space of life is completely falling apart. For me personally, it's not everybody's journey, but in my case, because I believe what I am, that's now becoming a ministry that you don't really plan, you know, when you're 16, that part of your purpose in life one day is going to be to tell people that you're a widow at 47. And I say it's semi-likely because, you know, we just don't think about it that way. But it is how God has been helping me. And I believe anybody that taps into what God has for us will go through this better. There's no easy, and there's real, and there's life, and there's we are in a fallen world, and all those things are still there. But really, the peace that transcends understanding of Philippians 4, it continues to be part of what happens to me every day, because you know, life happens, and things can get really nuts and crazy and overwhelming and sad and frustrating. In the beginning, it's moment by moment, and then hour to hour and day to day, and that's how you get through that, or how I got through it, and how a lot of the people I speak to get through it.
Athana, I think it's so important what you mentioned about your relationship with God being an essential part of what brought you through this period of grief and what helped you through the trauma and the shock. But I think oftentimes when we think about God, we can put him in a spiritual category, which he is, but we keep him there. So there's a spiritual side of grief and there's a physical, practical side of grief. But can you say that maybe God was even sustaining you in the practical and physical parts of the grief, or was he only there for you spiritually?
You know, I say to people, grief is all-encompassing. It affects your mind, it affects your body, it affects your spirit, and it affects your emotions. And spiritually, I was in a really good place. And emotionally, I anticipated it was going to be really difficult. But what I didn't anticipate was the physical impact that trauma had on us as a family and the mental things. You know, there's this trauma-related things that happen to your brain, and it's just your body protecting you. So it causes you to be very blurry and fuzzy. And I so much claimed a sound mind in that time. You know, I would literally just go, a sound mind. And I had to really fight it. And sometimes I wasn't equally successful, but I gave myself grace. I think in the beginning, I prayed, you don't have words, you know, your head just doesn't have that kind of capacity for, or certainly for most people I speak to. And all I said was, God help and God give me wisdom. And when I looked back at the time, I would go, wow, that was a good decision. All this helps, you know. And then I realized it was God that gave me wisdom. Mm-hmm. It wasn't because I was in a particularly wise space, but I made decisions that in retrospect landed up having been really good decisions. I wasn't always equal in that. I battled, for instance, to be as emotionally available to my children as I would want to be, because I was trying to just cope and not fall apart in front of them. I had my own counseling team and I encouraged my kids to do counseling. My daughter is very good at it. My son just said, no, he's fine. And if he wanted to talk, he'll talk to me, which of course you don't know if they already do, but he has to some degree. So I think, yes, God helps with everything because we are created by him and he sustains us and we have all the power of the package of what God gives us. But there is the reality of living in the world, although we're not of it. So certain things you have to experience. And, you know, that's what Jesus died for. He experienced grief. He experienced trauma by his choice. He did that so that now that I'm going through it, he had actually chosen to experience it as fully man and fully God so that he could be God for me. And so, yes, I don't think it means that you're going to be completely unaffected by physically and mentally, and you might need assistance, you know, in some way or another. And I really always tell people, I encourage them to go to a doctor to just speak through all the stuff, and that they just can even just test your blood pressure. You know, it doesn't help you die of stress during the grief process too, you know. So make sure that you get to a doctor, make sure that just the basics are sorted so that you can be as physically capable as you can possibly be to handle every day, because life doesn't stop because you are grieving.
I can just imagine, especially in light of what you've explained about your relationship with Desmond being extremely equal. You were equal partners in the marriage. I can just imagine the practical gaps that must have been left behind, you know, and it's, you know, now you sort of have to lift that weight as well, the weight of all the practical things that he was bringing to the family. And we can mention things like provision and just help with the children. So how can the community come around people who are grieving and support them, maybe in a practical way? What do you think are valuable forms of support from your community when you are grieving?
You know, depending on where you are on the scale, let's say as a widow, I think one of the most important things are that the actual person who has experienced the loss make a list of things people can do for you so that when people ask, you can tell them what you need. And I think especially Christian communities, Christian churches, you know, there's a lot of focus on orphans, but I think they forget a bit about the widows. And functional things like people being willing to help with things around the house will help a lot. I relearned very quickly to make a fire so that I could have heat in my house and braai myself, which was one of the big things you could ask most anybody, especially among younger widows. Like it's a fun question, have you braaied yet? Because, you know, that it's a definitive, really guy kind of thing. I think I always say to people, nearly 2 years down the line, you can still bring me a cooked meal and I'm going to be forever grateful. There's a lot of support in the beginning, and churches and things will help you maybe for a few weeks or 10 days or a month or whatever. But honestly, especially for single parents and older people, you know, I think what often happens is while there's somebody in your house that you cook for, you would be more likely to cook than if you're now alone at home. And I think it's a really simple thing, but I think most people will probably still enjoy somebody just cooking a meal for them, you know. And I think an awareness for the community for things that, like special days, like Christmas and birthdays, some people are prepared for that. And they have family that they can go to. And people would actually rather prefer to go to people that are not so connected to the loss, so the loss isn't so obvious. So in you know, thinking about a person that you could invite for Mother's Day, Father's Day, Christmas, you know, they might say no, but they might actually be immensely grateful that they're just going to be among other people, which is what friends of ours did for us for Christmas that first year. And it actually turned out to be quite a big breakthrough for my son, because he connected with somebody who's experienced a lack of a dad in the same age group, and they really connected. So I think, you know, being there for basic stuff. And then a really simple thing that I find really difficult is going to school functions and prize givings and stuff alone, and just sitting there like, you know, nobody to share a victory or whatever. And other parents in the community, especially in school, if they have a some kind of awareness of those people, and just phoning them up and saying, you know, can I pick you up and let's all go together to the prize giving or to the whatever. They might say no, but there's a great amount of people who's going to say, actually, that would be great. And then I think another thing that's important is to understand an awareness of those people's roles changing in their households. So people seem to think, especially in places where people are now single, so there's nobody in the house anymore, people think that because of that, they have less to do because they don't have to now look after who else was in the house. But your work actually doubles. Every bill, every decision about the house. And I think just to understand and have empathy about the role of who they are completely changed in an instant with no preparation. And it has its own impacts.
Afana, I'm so grateful for your time and also for the courage that you took to take the time to write this book so that it could be a ministry to other people who are grieving. Because I believe that there are even people who have lost you know, loved ones maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years ago, and they still haven't really dealt with the grief. Maybe they've been widows now for 10 years, but they still haven't worked through what has needed to be worked through for them to really heal and for them to not move on or move away from that, you know, because that gap will always be there, but for them to keep going with the Lord. So I really believe that this book will be a ministry to widows and anyone who's lost a loved one. A final question before we end off. Do you think it's possible for us to prepare for grief before it happens? You know, instead of waiting to discover the different ways that you react in grief, because I think grief, it's something we sort of deal with when it happens to us, when we're going through it. But on a day-to-day basis, I don't think a lot of us walk around and think, I wonder how I grieve. I wonder how to prepare for grief.
Yes.
So do you think that's something that we can and should be doing?
Yes. I think there are definitely things that you could do there. Death is not discriminatory. You know, we're all going to experience loss and we don't want to think about it at the time, you know. I think people think it's negative talking or speaking some kind of curse sometimes to say, oh no, I have to prepare for that. But the fact is, the Bible reminds us that we live in a world and there will be hardship, and God promises that He will be with us throughout it. I think, yes, as Christians, we have an opportunity to draw close to God now so that when things happen, we have an automatic response of prayer, that prayer isn't a last resort, but a first response. And the simple things remain the simple things, you know. It sounds like a cliche to say read your Bible, but everything you need to know about life that's coming is in God's word. For me, it's part of my testimony that I had 2 years basically where I really just got back into the habit of a quiet time, and I was working, so it meant initially that I had to get up even earlier, just 15 minutes, but I just made it part of my day. And so by the time things happened, I was sorted. I think the other thing that's really important, and something I think we have mislearned in COVID, and that is community. We have become very isolated. A lot of us now work from home for a lot of the time, and it's just easier than going out and reaching out, you know, to just stay indoors and be in your own space. And that's not really good for us. We were created to be between people. And I would really encourage you to become part of a community. For me, we had moved from Sedgefield to George a couple of years earlier, and I hadn't made proper connections. And 2 years before, when I realized, okay, now I need to be better at this, I did start going to a small group. I did start getting involved in church. I did start reaching out to the people who work with me and paid more attention to who they were. So that by the time things happened to me, there were people around me to help with practical stuff, but also just praying for me. And then I think the other good thing to do for yourself in preparation of the possibility that you might find yourself in a chain situation is to have things that's not totally intrinsic to your relationship to the other person, so that your whole structure of functioning doesn't completely collapse when that other person is there. So if you used to play tennis together, you know, also make a friend join a ladies or a men's group that play tennis, so that you don't stop doing stuff. Well, if you're a parent and you've started, your whole life evolves around your kids and getting them to places, and then, you know, something terrible happens and suddenly you have become defined by certain life situations, and when the situation changes, your whole identity goes with it. And I think there are two things important. Firstly, that your identity should be in God, which goes back to the relationship. And then I think the other big thing is that you also have things that that's just for you. Mm. So that, you know, when you are in this change situation, there are things that you can do, hobbies you can go back to, or things that can not make you completely feel lost. And then I think the last thing that I would say to people is prepare now to have your affairs in order. Mm. Don't leave the will. You know, make sure that your insurance policies have got the correct beneficiaries in them, mm-hmm. and don't extend it. You don't know what's going to happen. And if those things aren't in order, it gets really complicated. Mm-hmm. Silly things that I hear a lot about is, you know, when you've paid off a car, for instance, you're meant to get the documentation from the bank, especially if the car is older. It can be actually complicated to find that payment, and something like that can really delay the estate. So, you know, make sure you have all the documentation.
Afana, thank you so much for your time. You know, it just reminds me of Anna. It's probably a common thing, that a comparison that we will draw, but really just the fact that she also lost her husband very young, but she mm-hmm. spent the rest of her life living in the Lord's house and, you know, proclaiming the good news to people. So I really also pray and trust the Lord for the ministry that he's entrusted to you, that it will reach the people it needs to reach, that it will encourage them, and that they will most importantly be encouraged to draw near to the Lord. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I hope that you were encouraged and equipped by our conversation today. Thank you for joining Athana Schultz and myself for Woman Today. For more good news, you can head on over to our website, that's gncr.org.za, and I am available as Larice Furie on either Facebook or Instagram. So please feel free to reach out to me on either of those platforms, and I will see you again. Thank you so much for your time. Bye.